Welcome to the Food Revolution Summit, where we explore how you can heal your body and your world with food. This is Ocean Robbins, and I am joined by my dad and colleague, John Robbins, in welcoming our guest, Dr. Vandana Shiva. Vandana is a world-renowned advocate for environmental sanity and for the well-being and liberation of farmers and the rural poor. She is the founder of Navdanya, or Nine Seeds, which is a movement of hundreds of thousands of Indian farmers promoting biodiversity, organic farming, native seeds, and fair trade. Vandana is a recipient of the Right Livelihood Award, which is often called the Alternative Nobel Prize, and she's the director of the Research Foundation on Science, Technology, and Ecology. She's author of many best-selling books, including Stolen Harvest, The Hijacking of the Global Food Supply. Forbes has named her one of the seven most powerful women on the globe. Time selected her as an environmental hero, and Asia Week has called her one of the five most powerful communicators in Asia. Vandana combines sharp intellectual inquiry with courageous activism. Her work spans teaching at universities worldwide and working with peasants in rural India. So now, Vandana, we are so grateful to have this time with you. And now for the interview, I'm going to hand it over to my dad, John Robbins.
Thank you, Ocean, and thank you, Vandana, for being with us again. It's really a pleasure to have you.
It's a joy to be back.
Recently, the U.S. president met with the Prime Minister of India in Delhi, and they declared a new era of trust in the relationship between the two countries. Prior to their meeting, you wrote an open letter to them, urging them to protect seed freedom and food democracy, and to renounce the patenting of life. I co-signed your letter, Vandana, and I did so because I believe we need laws to protect people and the environment, instead of making it easy for corporations to take control over life forms for short-term profits. I believe that the freedom to save seeds is a fundamental right, as I know you do also. You first became involved with this issue in the 1980s, when corporations were first talking about how they wanted to include intellectual property rights in what was then known as the Free Trade Agreement that later became part of the World Trade Organization. What concerned you about this?
They were talking about owning and patenting seed as their future profits. For me, this was a deep violation of the fabric of the earth, the intrinsic value of species, the innovations of farmers over millennia, and the intellectual and biological heritage of biodiverse cultures. And that's when I started, 87, to both protect the seed as well as not cooperate with patent laws. We worked with our government, we worked with our parliament from that time onwards to make sure that the obscenity of patenting life did not get introduced in India's law. We have an article in the patent law that says biological processes are not inventions, that simple trivial changes are not inventions. I was part of the expert group that drafted our Plant Variety Act, which is usually a monopoly law, and we put into it farmers' rights, that the farmers' right to save, exchange, save seeds is absolutely inviolable.
I agree wholeheartedly with you that the rights of farmers to save their own seeds should be protected, for many reasons, really. And I want to pause for a moment here and give our listeners a context to fully appreciate the importance of what you are saying. Ever since the advent of agriculture, farmers have saved their seeds to use to plant the next season's crop. Today's large-scale industrial farms, on the other hand, don't save their own seeds. They buy them from large seeds companies who sell primarily a few standard varieties of seeds that are suitable for large monocultures, and that depend on expensive inputs of fertilizer, herbicides, and other pesticides. That's the industrial model. But small farmers around the world still produce much of the world's food, and they still depend on their own seeds. By saving their own seeds, they develop crops that thrive in their specific microclimate and bioregion, and that grow best in their particular soil. By saving their own seeds, they also save money. They don't need to buy the seeds themselves, and they can grow varieties that don't depend on expensive chemical inputs. Saving their own seed is critical to their ability to grow healthy food for their families and communities, and it is indispensable to their ability to sustain themselves financially. But now, Monsanto and the other biotech companies have managed not only to obtain patents on their genetically modified seeds, but also to use their enormous profits to buy up the seed companies that sell non-GMO seeds. Their goal is to control the global seed supply completely, and I find that to be a terrifying prospect. So now, Vandana, I'm hearing you say that the disturbing announcement made by the President of the United States and the Prime Minister of India pointed to a dismantling of Indian laws, laws which until now have protected farmers' basic right to save and plant their own seed. And this dismantling would in effect be giving a green light for Monsanto to proceed in India as they have in the United States, to assert greater and greater control and ownership of the agricultural sector.
That's why I wrote the open letter to Obama and Modi. Part of it was to recall history. Part of it was to converge the citizens' concerns of the U.S. and India, because when Obama and Modi meet, they have meetings with the corporations. And they make further commitments to the corporations, will give you even higher levels of monopolies and rip off society off the common good and deny society the public trust. So we are at a very precarious situation for the future of humanity and the future of the planet. And these issues of patenting life and patenting seed are at the heart of this threat.
They are, and we've watched Monsanto use intellectual property laws to assert dominance over the world seed supply. 50 years ago, seeds were overwhelmingly in the hands of farmers and public sector breeders, but now Monsanto by itself directly accounts for a quarter of the world's seed sales, and along with the next two biggest seed companies, DuPont and Syngenta, these three companies together sell almost half of the world's seeds. I hear you telling us, and I'm so glad you are, because I think it's so important that this be heard and recognized, that seed freedom is essential to food security, and that owning life by claiming it to be a corporate invention is not only ethically wrong, it's legally wrong. But it seems clear to me that Monsanto and these other agrochemical companies are intent on obtaining control over the world food supply. I shudder to think what will happen if we allow the corporate world to completely control our food. And I am so glad that you are standing, as are millions of people now, against this corporate takeover.
Absolutely. And then, you know, two other aspects linked to it. One aspect is the fact that you can't really invent life. Life is continuity of evolution. You can slightly modify it, but modification is not invention, just as much as a small renovation or replacement of a door in a house doesn't get interpreted as the construction of the house or the making of the house or the owning of the house. Now, even where it's bricks and mortar, we are far more careful to not assign property rights to someone who came and fixed a window. And in the case of life itself, we are assigning property rights to life's reproduction to those who put toxic genes into plants. Scientifically, legally, ethically, basically what's going on is pollution, not creation. And polluters should be punished, not rewarded with not just seeds of today, but seeds of the future, criminalizing our highest duty, which is to save seed. And on that duty rests seed freedom, and on seed freedom rests food democracy. Now, the Monsantos of the world are not just claiming these very false rights of creation. They are also claiming personhood and are threatening democratic movements, whether these are movements in Vermont, which got a labeling law passed, where the Grocery Manufacturers Association has been used to sue the government, or the county of Maui in Hawaii, which through the ballot said they would put a moratorium on GMO trials, because GMO trials in Hawaii are basically experiments with chemicals, the most lethal of herbicides and pesticides. Children are suffering. There's cancer epidemics. There's illnesses all around these experimental farms. And the people of Maui exercised their fundamental right under the Constitution of the United States. And they have been threatened and sued by Monsanto. So these rights that are being claimed are reaching absurdity on the one hand, but are becoming so total and so absolute that if we do not correct them in time, freedom, and with freedom, life itself will become impossible. That was the basis of my open letter, and while it was to Obama and Modi, it is really to citizens worldwide to say, we've got to wake up, we've got to act, we've got to join hands, we've got to become one humanity responding against this inhumanity of corporations pretending to be persons.
When you mentioned the most lethal of herbicides, I'm reminded of that the USDA recently approved the sale and planting of Monsanto's genetically engineered dicamba-tolerant soybeans and cotton. And this followed their approval of 2,4-D-tolerant soybeans and corn. These are genetically engineered crops that are being touted as the next generation of herbicide-tolerant crops and the answer to the ever-growing number of weeds that have predictably become resistant to Roundup. The USDA acknowledges that we now have more than 70 million acres in the United States infested with Roundup-resistant weeds. It seems to me to be completely obvious that the approval of dicamba-tolerant soy and cotton and 2,4-D-tolerant soy and corn is no answer at all, and that it's only a matter of time before we have tens and then hundreds of millions of acres filled with weeds that have become resistant to all three of these herbicides. What I want to ask you, Vandana, is how can that not be obvious to the USDA? And if it is, how can they justify these approvals?
I think the tragedy and problem with corporate rule and corporate domination is that the public agencies who should be regulating them become instruments of deregulation and approvals on a fast track, whether they be approvals of 2,4-D resistant corn and soya or the dicamba resistance. And interestingly, the endless duo of Dow and Monsanto, or DuPont and Monsanto, shows that these are not competitors. They join hands to bring the worst of toxics onto our table. It's not that USDA officials individually wouldn't be seeing it, but their hands are getting tied more and more. We need to recognize that there's a deep crisis when the democracy of the United States is reduced to a corporatocracy, and all of the foreign policy of the U.S. has been reduced to one agenda, pushing GMOs on other countries. So not only are these toxic pesticide-producing or pesticide-resistant products being imposed on the U.S. citizens through this deregulation and unaccountability, they're being imposed around the world.
There's a major effort to push them in Africa, I know.
In Africa, through AGRA and Bill Gates, who does all this in the name of philanthropy, has huge investments in Monsanto. His agenda and Monsanto's agenda is not separable. These issues are built into these bilateral pressures which are touted as partnerships. For example, the whole Obama visit to India, when it's talking about partnership between the two biggest democracies. Well, that partnership is about corporate totalitarianism to kill democracy in the U.S. and India. Or the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, again to push GMOs and intellectual property rights. Or the Trans-Pacific Partnership to do the same and to give corporations personhood to allow them to sue governments that defend the interests of their people, the environment, and the public good. As far as these new approvals are concerned, while on the one hand, it is surprising. But if you look at the roots of industrial agriculture, it's not at all surprising. Industrial agriculture was created by these same corporations that are today bringing us toxics via GMOs. They basically were chemical warfare companies. And the origins of chemical farming lie in the war. As I've said often, we are eating the leftovers of World War II. Now, that mindset, that paradigm hasn't changed. And that paradigm of war, war against the earth, war against other species, war against insects, war against plants as if they're weeds, all of these wars make it inevitable that you will use war instruments in our food production, which will ultimately poison our food and create a war against our bodies with multitudes of diseases that are being experienced. Now, there the corporations turn around and basically try and kill the messenger, whether it be Arpad Puzai or Seralini. And the second thing that's very important for your listeners to know is most of these agrochemical companies, which have become the seed corporations and the biotechnology corporations, also have huge interests in the pharmaceutical sector. So the more people get cancer, the more money they make through patented cancer drugs. And for them, every ecological crisis, health crisis, a farmer's crisis is a new market. That's the reason we've got to address this market domination directly and create a deeper democracy, which I call Earth democracy.
Earth democracy, yes, yes. I see elsewhere in the world, other than the United States, a lot of positive signs. Russia, for example, has completely banned GMOs. China has banned GMOs in military food supplies. Italy recently passed laws making planting GMO crops punishable from 1 to 3 years in prison. There are 64 nations now that mandate the labeling of GMOs. It seems to me that millions of farmers and consumers worldwide are awakening to the dangers inherent in GMOs and the failures of the industrial food model. Do you see that happening?
Yes, it is absolutely the biggest revolution taking place. And because this revolution is growing so fast, and it's growing because people are deeply aware of how toxic their food has become, it's not a theoretical discussion for them. It's not a lab report that's going to tell them. It's their body's own experience. The body is the ultimate lab. And as people fall sick, they shift to organic to survive. And as they shift to organic, or they shift to local, they want to know who grew their food. They want to know the farmer who grew their food. As these tighter, intimate links grow to create a more secure, more democratic food system, that is where the next attack of corporate warfare, literally, is coming. One side is make seed saving illegal, because without your own seeds, how do you grow your own food? The second is use fraudulent sanitary and phytosanitary measures, hygiene measures, to say local artisanal production is dangerous for health. And across the world, new sanitary and phytosanitary laws are trying to make local food systems illegal. Whether it be in Calabria, which created a zero-kilometer law to say we'll procure as close to home as possible, and they were threatened. Or the farmers who are growing free-range pigs and free-range animals being threatened for creating feral species. It's fascinating how on the one side there is this total craziness about owning life through patenting, claiming it's your invention. And on the other hand, denying hazards where they are in pesticides and GMOs, and seeing hazards wherever nature is at work and people are working to produce healthy, safe, delicious, tasty, nutritious food.
It's as though there's a clash of values here. On the one hand, there is the patenting of seeds and the use of ever more toxic chemicals in agriculture. But on the other, we have organic, local-scale agriculture that is based on seed freedom and food democracy. It seems as though what's at stake begins with how our food is grown and then spreads out and touches every facet of our lives, our souls, our spirits even.
Absolutely. And how our food is grown begins in our minds and our hearts. Because when our minds our militarized minds at war with the world, we will create food systems based on warfare. And when our minds begin with love for the diversity of this planet and the recognition that with the soil and with the seed we can be co-creators of healthy and safe food systems, then you create healthy and safe food systems. So it is not just a clash in values, it's a clash in worldviews.
Well, you've been at the forefront at the effort to protect the earth and healthy soils. And as you know, of course, 2015 has been designated as the International Year of Soils by the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations. In your remarkable book, which I love, Soil Not Oil, that's the title, you connect the dots between industrial agriculture and climate change and show that a world that is beyond dependence on fossil fuels is necessary and it's possible. In that book, I hear you saying that the actions we need to take to address hunger and poverty are actually the same ones that we need to take to address climate change. How is that so?
Well, as I've written in that book, and what I did was basically take the data of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which was not counting agriculture as a sector. But it had it in land use, and it had it in industrialization, and it had it in transport. So basically, by adding the contributions of an industrial agriculture model, including its long-distance transport, the figures I came out with was 40% of all greenhouse gas emissions are coming from that industrial model. These include the fossil fuel dependence, whether it be fossil fuels to produce the chemical fertilizers or to run the heavy machinery that got rid of farmers or to transport food and contribute to food miles. All of that is the carbon dioxide emissions. But the use of nitrogen fertilizers leads to the emissions of nitrogen oxide, which is 300 times more lethal in terms of destabilizing climate patterns than carbon dioxide is. And then this industrial, large-scale, long-distance food system only produces 30% of the food, but it wastes half of what it produces. Half of what is produced is then thrown into dumps. Those dumps are then emitting methane. Animals are being put into factory farms. 10 units of energy produce 1 unit of grain in the industrial system. And that 1 unit of grain produces 0.1 unit of protein in an animal. So you're taking 100 units and reducing them to 1. In the process, torturing the animals and leading to high level of emissions of methane. When we make a shift to ecological, organic, local food systems, the first thing that happens is you get rid of the long distance transport, you get rid of the emissions from nitrogen oxide, you get rid of food waste, and you get rid of giant farms depending on giant machinery and huge fossil fuel use. We are literally eating oil in the industrial food system, whereas we eat soil in the ecological system. We've done calculations for India. The Rodale Institute has done calculations. Across the world, there are long-term studies showing that the amount of carbon we can return to the soil through organic matter recycling, that not only can take most of the carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere and put the carbon where it belongs in the soil, but that increased soil fertility can double, triple food production. Albert Howard, who was sent to India in 1905, arrived and saw the soils fertile, no pests in the field. He said, I'm going to turn the Indian peasant and the pest into my professors. And then he wrote the book, The Agricultural Testament, which is called the Bible of Modern Organic Farming. In his work, he could show that through the composting systems 300% increase in productivity just by serving the soil and taking care of giving back to the soil according to the law of return. Because this is the year of soil, we actually are going to be organizing a tour beginning on Gandhi's birth anniversaries, 2nd October to 5th of October, going to Gandhi's center in Sevagram, where he led the freedom movement through the spinning wheel, and then to Howard's center in Indore, where he taught the world how organic farming is a solution to hunger and poverty.
Well, that is so needed. And when you speak of Gandhi, I think of how he protested with his life, the effort to make it illegal to make your own salt. And now we have to protest the effort to make it illegal to save your own seeds.
Absolutely. And, you know, that protest he called Satyagraha. Satya meaning truth, agraha meaning the force of truth. Practiced it the first time on a 9/11 in 1906 when they were trying to put the apartheid regime in place in South Africa. He came back to India only in 1915. Most of his early work was in South Africa to fight apartheid. And then he worked on the salt, he worked on the compulsory planting of indigo. And we at Navdanya, the movement for seed saving I started, have taken inspiration from the spinning wheel to say we'll save our own seeds, and from the salt satyagraha to say we will do seed satyagraha, we will obey the higher laws that come from the earth and from the seed, that we have to save the seed, and therefore we will not obey Monsanto laws that make it illegal for us to save seeds. And all the seed libraries that are being threatened right now, I hope they will make declarations of a seed satyagraha this year in 2015 to remind themselves and the world that that higher duty to the seed and the future must guide our action. We wouldn't have had Martin Luther King if he wasn't inspired by Gandhi. You wouldn't have had a civil rights movement. There wouldn't be Obama as president today, and he acknowledged that in one of his talks in India. He acknowledged that Gandhi's inspiration to Martin Luther King and Martin Luther King's inspiration to him is the reason he could even become a president of the United States. Now, how can he deny citizens of the U.S. the kinds of freedoms that made him the president?
It bothers me that he does not take more actions in accord with Martin Luther King's vision, with Gandhi's vision. Many of us hoped he would when he was first elected, but he hasn't been able to do, even if he's wanted to. It's been a very difficult time in the United States, and you're aware of this because you have been working for so many years to help us make peace with the earth. And as a result of your profoundly needed efforts and your courage, you've been personally attacked by apologists for Monsanto and its allies. And I want you to know, Vandana, and I speak now for the more than 100,000 people who are listening to us right now, in saying that we and I honor you for your courage, and we thank you for the beautiful and heartfelt wisdom you carry for us all.
Thank you so much, John.
Well, I want to thank you for so many things. You continually remind us all that humanity and the earth are at a critical juncture, that patents on seeds and seed monopolies are eroding biodiversity, they're eroding farmers' rights, they're eroding the freedom of every human being. And I so appreciate you for telling us again and again in different ways that the freedom to save seeds is essential to our ability to address hunger and malnutrition, and it's an imperative if we're going to bring back taste and nutrition and quality in our food. And of course, I want to thank you, Vandana, for being with us today and for your passionate and deeply needed efforts to remind us all again and again, including our presidents and prime ministers, that corporations are not people and that an assault on democracy is not free speech.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much, John and Ocean. It's always a joy to be back.
We've been talking with Dr. Vandana Shiva, founder of Navdanya, which can be found at navdanya.org. Vandana, your insights are refreshing, they're inspiring, they're galvanizing. We want to thank you for the bridges that you build between North and South, between science and soil, and between words and actions. Your work is an inspiration to millions, and we thank you for it. It has been a pleasure and an honor to speak with you, and we are so grateful for your partnership and your leadership in the food revolution.
Thank you.
This concludes our interview, but our work is just getting started. If you feel excited by what you just heard and want to share it with other people in your life, if you want permanent access to 24 more amazing presentations and transcripts, then we have an offer to share. You can get a download and a transcript of the entire Food Revolution Summit, plus a huge collection of bonus resources from our speakers and partners. This empowerment package is available for a major discount between now and the end of the summit. For more information, please visit foodrevolution.org/empowerment. Again, that's foodrevolution.org/empowerment. Thank you so much for joining us in the Food Revolution.